This morning, in this first part of the show, we'll be talking with Rebecca Buzel, the author of the book An Exposure of the Heart. It's published by W.W. Norton. Ms. Buzel, good morning. Thanks very much for being with us today. I enjoyed your book very much. It is a very moving book, and as I was saying before, I'm not really sure if an interview can convey what is in this book. We can try, but I guess that to appreciate the book, one would have to go out and read it.
Well, I hope that the listeners will do that.
Well, tell us, let's start from the very beginning. You got a grant to go and take photographs in this institution that was for developmentally disabled folks in New York. Well, first of all, tell us about the place. What sort of a place is it, and who are the people that are there?
The institution is an extremely large institution in New York State. At one time, there were 5,000 people incarcerated there. It's the population has now been reduced to about 1,500, but that's still a huge number of people all in one place in 23 great big stucco buildings on a hilltop in rural New York State.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are in there are people who have been diagnosed to have developmental disabilities in some cases. Those are the most recent people who've been admitted. There are also people there who have been there for a lifetime and who were rounded up on the streets of New York primarily for being indigent or for being crippled or being different in some way and who've never gotten out. And that, I think, was almost the most horrifying thing for me, is knowing that there were people in there whose thought processes were the same as yours and mine,
mm-hmm.
and who, because they had nobody looking after them, are still there. The other thing I think that's important to keep in mind is that these people are all the sons and daughters of bankers and business people and factory workers and artists. So they represent the children of a cross-section of our population.
I think, as you say, that one of the things that struck me as I was reading about some of these folks is that that feeling that some of them probably shouldn't be there, or at some time in their life, if they had gotten really... they've gotten real strong support, very loving care, the right kind of teaching, that probably they would be able to live successfully on their own, or maybe in a setting where they had some kind of support. But that again, that there were people in there that just shouldn't have been in this place. And if someone had cared enough to try to help them, they wouldn't have been.
I think that's absolutely right. And as I say, that was the most difficult problem for me as I got to know some of these people. There are people there who were definitely not in any way retarded when they went in. Now, I'm using that word in quotation marks, by the way. The accepted term is developmentally disabled now. But I think the listeners may... react and know what we're talking about a little bit more if we do use this old-fashioned word retarded now and then. So let me say that some of these people who were not at all disabled when they went in have become functionally retarded. They have been incarcerated with people who are in far worse shape than they are, and they wouldn't know how to live. They would have to be totally retrained now, and they can be totally retrained.
I think, though, too, the other thing that one has to acknowledge is that also some of the people that were living there could not have survived because of, for whatever reason, because of their condition, could not have gotten along, even in the most supportive kind of environment outside that institution.
Well, I think that is and isn't true. It has been proved in recent years that even the most physically fragile of that population can be supported in home-like community settings given the proper staffing.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is the trick to it.
Yeah. Tell us why it is that you wanted to take this project on in the first place.
I'm a photographer who likes to take photographs in series. I like to spend time with my subjects, and I like to really get into whatever it is that I'm photographing. So I had begun a project up here where, under a grant from the National Endowment, I had been photographing people who had been released from this institution and were living in our small, rural New York State community. And as I got to know these people, I became more and more curious about their lives because they didn't seem that different. Some of them stuttered and some of them couldn't complete a sentence. Others could. And none of them seemed developmentally disabled enough to have been institutionalized. So I became very curious about what their lives had been like. Now, my husband was also working at the institution as a planner. He's an architect by profession. And so I knew something about it, but I'd actually only dealt with the administrative side. I hadn't actually gotten to know any of the clients. So it was curiosity. It was a feeling that this was a very large factor in our community and a place that people knew very little about, and that I wanted to integrate it personally into my own life and have a feeling for what really went on there. So that's why I began the project.
When you talk in the very beginning part of the book about your feelings going there for the first time with your camera, and it seems that it was so emotionally confusing and buffeting and rugged that you ended up leaving that first day without having taken any pictures. Is it possible now to resurrect some of those feelings and talk about just what it was like that first time that you went in?
Well, I was completely overwhelmed. I had never seen people who were as physically different from the people that I was used to. The folks that I had been photographing in the community were what is known in that population as the higher functioning clients, meaning that they are more, quote, normal, both physically and mentally. I went to the building where the most physically fragile people are, and I had never seen a seizure before. I saw a seizure that day. I had never seen people with physical defects such as hydrocephalus, which is an enlarged head. I felt as though I had been let down into some sort of a nightmare world, and I didn't take any pictures because I was so frightened of objectifying these people. I just couldn't imagine what I had in mind in the first place. I knew that my goals had been to make them somehow to show the aesthetic and visually graceful side, but I couldn't find it that first day while I was there, and I was terribly relieved to be let out of the building. Yeah. I thought I never would go back.
How did you manage to get yourself to go back?
Sheer willpower. That good old thing that pushes us through a lot of situations, and I'm afraid I have to admit to a certain amount of pride. I had applied for a grant. I had written a fine proposal which had been funded, and it's not the kind of thing where after one day you say, I quit, I can't do it. I also look around our community, and there are 2,500 people working as staff members at that institution. Now, they're able to go in there every day. So I knew I wasn't such a rarefied creature that I really, literally couldn't stand it.
Mm-hmm. On your first day there, you met a girl that is That was one of the important stories of the book, your relationship with her. Her name is Emily. Tell us about Emily.
Oh, Emily was my love. She was my guidepost. She was a very, very important young woman. She's a 12-year-old girl in the book, An Exposure of the Heart. And when I met her, she had an IQ of under 30. She did not speak at all. She made twisting motions with her body. She made funny little sort of kazoo-like hums. She had mild cerebral palsy, and so she had limp. And she also had a curiosity about her admittedly very small world that I simply found terribly interesting. She was gaga seeing this strange woman with a great big camera, and I was carrying a speed graphic camera, which is the old press photographer's camera from the 50s, the kind that, oh, that you see in movies about the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, she was intrigued with me, and I was simply delighted to see somebody that I felt I could photograph. And she was the first person that I photographed, and she and I latched on to each other. And from then on, it was a year of deep involvement with her and finally with her grandmother.
Mm-hmm. You, at one point in the book that you write, you writing about Emily, you write the fact that first you say that you were afraid that Emily would become too dependent on you, but then you go on to say really what you were feeling was that you didn't want to come too dependent on her, and that she was a very important in your, perhaps in your emotional survival in that place, she was very important. What I wonder, did she do for you?
Well, she had such a fresh little view of life. It was a small view. I don't want to tell you that she swept in and opened up enormous intellectual paths for me. But she was so clear with her emotional attachments. She was so clear about what she wanted and needed. And she was in a situation where she couldn't get what she wanted and needed. I used her as a guide. I used her as an emotional anchor. And I did become nervous about that. I did wonder if that wasn't quite a burden to put on this little girl. But I found that every time that I left one part of the institution where I felt comfortable, where I'd gotten to know the staff and gotten to know the clients, and moved on to another part of the institution, I had to start all over again. And I would go out for the day and make photographs and talk to people, but I'd always return to Emily. She and I felt at home together. We liked to walk the halls. We liked to walk outside together. She had extraordinary vision. She could pick out, one of the things that I remember and that I wrote about, is that she could pick out a dandelion gone to seed in the middle of a great, huge, enormous field of dandelions. And she would let me blow that wonderful puff in her face. And she was just a charming, charming child.
Yeah. We're talking with Rebecca Buzel about her book, An Exposure of the Heart, that is a story of the year that she spent working, taking photographs, and getting to know people who lived in an institution for developmentally disabled. This is in New York State. It has recently been published. We're talking with her, and again, at some point here, you might want to get involved in our conversation. Perhaps you'll have questions or want to share your thoughts. You can do that by calling us. Anywhere that you live, you can use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Of course, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, we do have a local number, and that's 333-9455. You're talking about your relationship with Emily and how you felt about her. It makes me also think that there was a point, I guess a couple of points, where you got some criticism from the staff. Some of it, I think, from one person in particular was angry and intentionally hurtful, some that was maybe a little bit more well-meaning, about the fact that, and this perhaps was in the beginning of your time there, that you were only taking pictures of in a sense, the people that were easy, that were easier emotionally to deal with, people that could give you some feedback in return, the ones that would be, the most normal, quote-unquote, and I hate to use that word,
yeah,
but it's the only one I can reach for right at the moment. Was that, do you think that was true at that point, and is that something that changed over time?
I think that definitely was true, and I think that was one of the very, very valuable lessons of the year. This aide there pointed out to me that all of the clients there needed love and attention, and that they were all equal, no matter how they looked. There were also some parents who came, the only parents, as a matter of fact, in that particular building, who came to visit their child regularly, and they pointed out the same to me. I hope that I got better at it as the year went on. I hope that my vision broadened and expanded and was able to include people that I'd not wanted to look at before. But that really is one of the points of writing a book like this. An Exposure of the Heart, I think, was written with the hope that people reading it would have their eyes opened and, beginning from wherever they were, start to see people in a different light, people who are different than they are.
You just talked about the one client whose parents came. One of the things that's striking is that most of these people seem to have very little contact with their families, and that many of them don't have any contact with their families.
Well, it's true, and it's particularly true, of course, of the older population there. As I say, in the 30s in New York City, there were, before the 30s, up to the 30s, there were laws on the books called the Poor Laws, which simply allowed anybody who was indigent or unwanted to be put away. And I found that a very chilling phrase, because it happened. It was real. If your family couldn't take care of you for whatever reason, they could simply put you away. So a lot of these people there were unwanted by their families and have no contact at all.
There were you visited with a lot of, and tell us about a lot of different kinds of people. There was one building called Evergreen where there were a number of old women who were living there, and I guess that some of these women had virtually been in institutions all their lives. There was one woman who had been there for 50 years.
Right.
Tell us sort of about them. It seems that these are some of the kind of people that you're talking about. Some
That's
of whom
right.
were just put there because, you know, either their families didn't want to deal with them or there was nowhere else for them to go, and so they had been living there for all of their adult lives.
That's absolutely right. The one woman that I write about, who is in her late 80s now, had been institutionalized, I believe it was in 1904 or 1906. She described to me the buggy ride that she took, the horse and carriage ride that she took to the ferry on the east side of Manhattan, which took her over to the House of Refuge on Welfare Island. And she began a lifetime of incarceration there because she was crippled. She spent those first years on her hands and knees. She did not have crutches. There were no wheelchairs. And she was on her knees for 26 years on knee pads. So when she came to Wasaic, she was given her first wheelchair. And what's staggering is to recognize that the gratitude that people have are for something like an electric wheelchair now. And when you think back on what this means in terms of somebody's, the poverty, the emotional poverty of somebody's life, it's a very difficult and heartbreaking situation.
I'm thinking, and I guess it's because it's a section in the book where that we've just been talking about the way in which some of these people reacted to you and the way that they felt about their surroundings. And I'm thinking about there's a point here where you were talking with a woman named Gertrude, and you you went into her room and you sat down and started talking with her, apparently the way that you had many times in the past, and you were having a conversation, and suddenly she says to you, very suddenly, why are you bothering me?
Right.
And you say, I didn't know that I was bothering you. And she goes on to say, every day you come here, what do you want with me? And you say, I've been taking pictures of you, and I've enjoyed our talks. I come here because I like you. And it's there seemed to be suddenly this very odd sort of conversation that took you by surprise. And I guess the impression that you get is that perhaps in part this woman is a little bit suspicious of you, and mm-hmm. she wants to know what your game is. But the other thing that you think is that somehow she's managed to adjust to her surroundings. She's made an adjustment, and that you're kind of mucking things up. And I wonder if there were other people that reacted to you in that way, both this sort of dual suspicion about, well, what is it that you want here? And also this feeling that, look, I've sort of adjusted to this place, and now you're muddying the waters here.
Yeah. Well, I certainly think that was true in her case. In fact, I know it was. And she went on to say, when she dismissed me in that way, she went on to say, I've got a couple of friends. I've got one who comes to visit me every Easter. And she named somebody else who came once a year in July. So she indeed had adjusted to a life of total emotional deprivation, and she did not trust or understand what my interest was in her, and I could see that. I would say that I did not have that reaction from very many people. Generally, if there was a negative reaction, it was from the staff. Although, again, the majority of the staff was very welcoming and, I think, glad to have the diversion, glad to have somebody else. And certainly for the clients, and that's another word, by the way, that we have to use in quotes, and it's not my favorite word, but that is the chosen and designated word by the state of New York for people who are in the institution. I think it's cold, but we will continue to use that. So the clients, for the most part, were glad to see me and glad to have a little extra something going on in their lives. I remember one time talking about old women where I didn't actually photograph them. I simply went around the room and set off my strobe in front of everybody. I didn't have enough film to photograph everybody, but they all wanted to be included. They all wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah. I guess that the other thing, you know, another thing that strikes you about a lot of these folks is that they are really, they seem hungry for human contact.
Absolutely.
And two, they also, I guess, well, like everybody, they want what freedom they can have. And you know, the Emily, I think after you had established a relationship with her and had taken her out a couple of times, it seemed that every time that you would show up, she'd be sort of ready, wanting to drag you to the door.
That's right.
As if she was saying, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be common to a lot of these folks, is that they felt confined, and they wanted contact with other people. And if they could, they wanted to get outside, even though maybe for some of them that was a frightening prospect.
Yes. Yes, I agree with that, David. And you used the two most important words when you were describing that, and those are like everybody. We all have that need for freedom and independence. We all need varying human company and varied human contact. And that's why I believe it's so incredibly important for us to get people out of these enormous institutions and to get them settled in homes, in houses where meals are cooked in kitchens and served to them piping hot right after they're cooked, not brought in, trekked from building to building on steam trays, where they're used to seeing the same people day after day and different shifts and staff changes and so on and so forth aren't always going on. But it is a like everybody situation. They want the same things we want. And when you look at people that we have put out of our sight and out of our mind and that we don't want to deal with in this light, then our own deprivation of our full humanity becomes very evident, because there are people who, through no fault of their own, we are not allowing to be like everybody.
Yeah. It gives me an opportunity to just, again, mention one thing that really struck me in the book that connects with that. It's an incident where you're with Emily, and you had brought in some balloons that you had bought for her, and they all had her name, Emily, printed on them.
Right.
And you write, "I blew up one and tied it, then I blew up a red balloon and tied it, then I blew up a blue balloon, an orange one, a yellow one. I liked the idea that they all had her name on them, though I knew it made no difference to her, but other people would see them and know she was not invisible."
Right.
And that's really, that for me, that's kind of the book right there, what it's about.
That's great. I'm so glad you saw that.
Well, I want to take just a minute here to talk to tell people who are listening about upcoming programs, and then we're going to continue to talk. Our guest is Rebecca Buzel. We're talking with her about her book, An Exposure of the Heart. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and we are talking this morning with Rebecca Buzel. She is a photographer and also author of the book, An Exposure of the Heart. It is published by W.W. Norton, and it is a story of her experiences taking photographs in an institution for developmentally disabled people in New York, and the story of how she came to know these people, about how it changed her, how it changed her family. It's a very moving book, and I think you get some idea from listening to us talk here. You get some idea, but again, I think it's a book you have to read to appreciate and to feel. So perhaps if at the end of the program you catches your interest, you'll want to go out and take a look at the book. I want to talk a little bit about the experience that you had really and that drew in your family did affect them. Early on, you tell your family about having met Emily and what was she like, and you had a son and a daughter. And your daughter apparently really, from right away, decided that she would like to meet Emily. She wanted to know more about her. And your son, though, seemed to be very hesitant and very afraid, and from the beginning said, "Well, I don't like this, Mom. I don't want to deal with this." And that continued for quite a while. Although at the end, your son seemed to change his feelings about that. Why do you think it was that your children reacted so differently?
Well, first of all, I simply realized more and more during that year that these are two very different people with two very different interests. And it's interesting now, because my daughter is in college in Massachusetts, and she is now working in a halfway house for schizophrenic women in her weekend hours. So she has a natural interest in this, in persons that are different than those that she's used to seeing. But my son at that time, he was 12 years old. He was just into puberty. He hadn't grown to his full height. He's a 6'4" boy now, 19-year-old. But at that time, he weighed 98 pounds. He felt physically threatened. He felt emotionally threatened. His mother had made a friendship with a girl his own age who couldn't speak and who wasn't able to communicate in the usual manner of communication, and he found it very emotionally threatening.
Mm-hmm.
they are different people. They have to work through their own process in a different way. And I think what was difficult for me was that I wanted them both to accept everything that went on right away. I wanted to have the perfect family. I wanted to have the all-embracing, all-encompassing family. And it didn't work out that way. It turns out that people have their own rhythms and their own patterns.
At the end of this year, you brought some of these ladies, the old ladies, from the Evergreen home to your home at Christmas time, and I think that it seems that by that time your son had started to come around. What do you think made that change possible? Was it just the fact that he had grown up a bit, or was it that actually having some contact managed to replace whatever irrational fears that he had had?
Well, I think that's it. It's all a matter of contact. And it was really, it was almost as though you could see his growth and see his change during that evening that the old women were with us. He hung back, he hung on the sidelines when they first came, and then one of them sat down and started talking to him about baseball. And he was staggered. He didn't realize that people were going to be able to deal with him on a level that he could understand. So when he began to get hooked into that, then his fear level went down, and he was able to be more expansive himself. At the end of the evening, after they'd gone home, we sat down at the table together, and I started to make this little thank you speech to my family, who had all been absolutely wonderful to these old women. And Max cut me off right in the middle of it, and he said, "Oh, come on, Mom, don't go on that way. They're only people, you know." And for me, that was the most gratifying phrase he'd ever spoken. I still don't think that Max will ever be a social worker, but he is a very successful human being. He's a very charitable, thoughtful, and sensitive young man, and that's all that I'm asking of him.
There was also a point where you had a visit from your father.
Yes.
Who at the time he had fairly recently retired, within I guess a couple of years.
Yes.
He had been a surgeon. And was familiar with Wassaic and had been there. He had seen the place, and talks about how depressed he was going through there, and that you then sort of went on and had a rather difficult conversation about euthanasia.
Yes.
And what I thought about it, reading that, was wondering whether this wasn't his, you know, whether he wasn't really struggling with his own fears about being disabled by age, and that he, you know, he was, I guess he was sort of more afraid what might happen to him, really, in the future.
Well, I think that's a very sensitive reading of yours, and I think that probably is what was going on. I think it was for him, as he put it, he said that he had worked in state hospitals, and he lives in St. Louis, by the way, so he's out there in your part of the world.
Uh-huh.
But he said he had worked in state hospitals for the mentally ill before, and he always felt hope in those hospitals, but that he felt going through Wassaic and seeing so many people who were severely brain damaged, that there was no hope for these people. And yes, I was surprised by his point of view on euthanasia, and it wasn't one I found that I subscribed to when he and I talked about it, and I guess we almost argued about it. But I do think that there are implications. How we treat people who are in difficult situations, such as these people who were in Wassaic Developmental Center, does have ramifications on how we treat old people who are in nursing homes. These things are all connected.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. He probably did have some sort of a specter of himself as an elderly person.
What sort of emotional changes do you think that having spent this year there and having gotten to know these people brought about in you?
Well, they were absolutely vast. It was a turn around year for me. It certainly helped me to heal some wounds that I'd had about a stillbirth that I'd had many, many years ago as a young mother. There was an old lesson that I keep having to learn over and over, and that is that my fear is created by my lack of knowledge of situations and people. I would say that I developed a sense of gratitude for my own physical and mental well-being and for that of my family and my friends. It was something that I've always taken for granted, and this year there brought me up face to face with it all the time. And I think I have to add here at the end that I learned an awful lot about my own imperfections too. I made a lot of mistakes during this year, and I've tried to be honest about them in the book and not whitewash myself. But there were a lot of lessons there. A lot of things went wrong, and there were ways in which I behaved oddly with my son Max, and in which I was pushy with clients and tried to force a reality on them that was my reality and not their reality, and these were all things that had to be examined. So it was a very important year for me.
Hmm. I wonder if your kids, your dad, your husband, have they all read the book and what they think about it?
Well, they have read the book, and I thought it was possible my father would never speak to me again. As a matter of fact, I was very moved because he called me and asked me if I would inscribe a copy of the book to a man in Chicago whom he reveres above all other men. He felt that the book served a purpose, and that's all I could ask for. I'm afraid I heard from my sister last night that he refers to himself now as the man who didn't come off very well in her book. So that was his reaction. My daughter, who's now finishing her sophomore year in college, was a constant reader through all of the drafts. And there were many drafts, by the way. This began as an 800-page document and was edited down by me over the course of 3 years into a manageable and readable 300 pages, which is what now constitutes an exposure of the heart. So she had read it all along. My husband has been marvelously supportive throughout this whole process, and he's still there at Wasaic. So he's taking all the day-to-day flack. Actually, the reaction at Wasaic has been very positive and very encouraging. I'm not sure that the administrative reaction is all that keen on the book, but he's been dealing with that in a very straightforward and wonderful way. And my son Max would not read the book until it was published and read it right before he took off to spend some time in Sun Valley, Idaho, and he too has been one of my staunchest supporters since he read it. So I'm very grateful to all of them. I think that they've rallied around what is a difficult subject for all of us in a wonderful way. It's all I could ask.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left. Rebecca Buzel is our guest. We're talking with her about her book, An Exposure of the Heart. It is a story of a year that she spent working as a photographer in and around an institution for developmentally disabled folks in New York. And it is... The book doesn't have any photographs in it other than the one on the jacket. It is a story about how it changed her and the effect on her family. It's published by W.W. Norton. It's a very, very moving book. We do have a little while left here. We're going to continue to talk some more, of course, but if you have questions, please do give us a call. One thing that we haven't talked about yet is the staff who work at WASAIC. And you just mentioned the fact that perhaps the administrators weren't real keen on the book. And one can see why, because, one gets the feeling that the people who work in this place, who work with the clients, their word, who work with the clients, are continually frustrated by the bureaucracy that they work under.
Yes.
And that that the place is chronically understaffed.
Yes.
Probably also under-equipped, that they really not only did they not have enough people, they don't have the stuff that they need to take care of these people, and that they are occasionally have to deal with probably just plain stupid orders that somebody decides would be a good thing and come, sort of flutter down from on high, and then they have to actually try to make them work. And some of them seem to be really quite bitter about the conditions that they have to work under.
I think that's absolutely true. There are some stunning examples of that kind of problem in the book. For instance, there was one time when the powers that be in Albany, which is, by the way, an hour and a half from WASAIC, and Albany, of course, is the state capital of New York and where the Office of Mental Retardation is. In Albany, it was decided that 76% of the clients at WASAIC should be on medication, and there were more than that on medication. So some arbitrarily simply had to be taken off of medication simply to fill that percentage. There was another time when an administrator decided that though many of these clients have a mental age that corresponds to an age of childhood, that they should no longer be playing with childlike toys. So where these clients had spent time working puzzles and so on and so forth, these were suddenly scooped up and put in a garbage bag and hauled off without any substitution being made in their curriculum. These kinds of things were terribly, terribly difficult for the staff to deal with, and understandably so.
You have to wonder how it is that these people manage to maintain the strength to go and do this job day after day.
Yeah.
I really can't quite understand it myself. Did you have some insight into that? Did you feel that you got to the point where you understood how these people could do this extremely difficult job?
Well, there, of course, is a huge variety within the staff. Some of them are there because they have very high ideals and very high principles. How they are able to maintain those in the face of the bureaucracy is still miraculous to me. There are other people there who do it simply for the money, and the money is pretty good in our part of the world. We are very rural. We're quite an isolated county. And this is, WASAIC Developmental Center is the second largest employer in the county. The first largest employer is IBM. So there aren't a whole lot of jobs available, and I think that's one of the things that keeps people coming back. As you read the book, you saw such a variety in the quality of the staff.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that those that are simply doing it for the money are pretty evident. But I agree with you. I think it's an extremely, extremely tough job. And I grew to have enormous respect for those who simply showed up every day and were able to do it. I was continually aware of the fact that I could go home whenever I wanted to, and that put me in a very different category from everybody else there.
We have a caller here. We'll talk with this person as we come into about our last 3-4 minutes. Right here on one of our local lines, number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask your guest why she decided to have the book be text and not include pictures. I've not read the book, so I don't know what her thinking was on that, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
I'm glad your listener asked me that question, because it is one that I've been asked a number of times. When I did the photographs are very strong. They're extremely graphic. My publishers felt, and I agreed with them, that this is such a tough subject to deal with. There are people find this so very difficult, that if they opened a book like this and they saw the photographs, it would be much easier for them to just close the book and say, whoa, I can't deal with it. If you read the book, I take the reader by the hand. I join at the hip with the reader, and we go through this experience together. Photographs are very immediate. Writing words allow you to ease in and out of situations, I think, in a more gentle way. So that is the primary reason that the photographs aren't there. The secondary reason is a reason of privacy. In a book like this, I think that readers would be looking for illustrations. They would want to say, oh, there's Tilly, there's Gertrude, there's Emily. And legally, with the state of New York, I can't do that. That's one of the things that you lose when you're institutionalized is your right to sign away releases and such. So those are really the two reasons.
Hmm. At the end of the year, Emily left Wasaic and went to, I'm not quite sure what the correct technical name for this kind of place is.
A community
more,
resident.
Okay. It's more like a home.
Yes.
I mean, like that is, well, not a home, but, you know, like the home that anybody would like to have. Not an institution. It's not like a hospital, which I'm sure was a much more pleasant place, at least to you looking at it, it seemed to be a much more pleasant place. And she seemed to be, at least the feeling I get is that she seemed to be excited about moving on to a new kind of life. For you, that must have been, there must have been great mixed feelings at that point, seeing her go off, because you must have known that probably would be the, not maybe that you would never see her again, but that you wouldn't have the kind of contact that you had all through this year.
That's right. Yes, that was a hard thing for me. And again, I try to be honest in the book, and to I had foreshadowings that this was going to happen, and I would find myself going in and out and thinking, oh, I know this is good for her, but I hate to see her go. And those were human feelings, and in a way they were a measure of my love and acceptance of her just as a human being. It was like any friend who's moving. If they're moving someplace that's going to benefit them, you're glad that it's happening for them, but for yourself it can be a loss. And it was, but the situation has been marvelous for her. She is near her grandmother, and as you say, she is in a home-like situation, and I think she's a much happier young woman now.
Mm-hmm. So you have had the opportunity to see her on occasion?
I have seen her once since then, and it was a very joyful time for me.
Well, we've come to the end of the time, I want people to know that I think it's a fine book. I guess I try not to say that very often, because I don't think I should be in the business of really trying to push things too much. But again, I think from listening to our conversation, you can only get a hint of what the book is like, and that to appreciate it and to feel that you've really got to read it. So I will suggest to folks that they might want to take a look at the book. The title again is An Exposure of the Heart. Rebecca Buzel is the author. It's published by W.W. Norton. It's in hardcover. Will there be a softcover edition of this coming?
Well, I think there will be, but it won't be for over a year. So I would urge your listeners to go to your local bookstore, and if they don't have it, make a fuss.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Rebecca, for talking with us.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for your sensitive reading of the book.